This is Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM in San Francisco. This is Arab Talk with Jess and Jamal. I'm Jess Hannam.
And I'm Jamal Dajani.
Jamal, we have a great show today. There is, as usual, much to cover today. We're going to be talking about an ex-Israeli general who gave a very compelling interview recently. And he said that what the Israeli army is partaking with in the West Bank amounts to war crimes and is similar to Nazi Germany. Very provocative thing for an ex-Israeli general to say. We're going to cover that. To me, this next story is also very interesting because we've been talking about it a lot. A Democratic congressional delegation is under fire for a recent visit to Israel that was funded by AIPAC. Surprise, surprise. Now, what is interesting about this is that it's the same AIPAC that invited the Democrats, is the same AIPAC that's working to defeat Democrats in the upcoming election. And who is the head of the Democratic delegation that went? None other than Hakeem Jeffries. So we're going to be talking about that.
I can't remove the image of Hakeem Jeffries looking so adorably and admiring Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, it was bro love. I would say that Hakeem and Benjamin Netanyahu have bro love, and that bro love is translating into a kind of attack on his own party, because he's supposed to lead the Democratic Party. He goes on this junket. The AIPAC is working to get rid of Democrats. So we'll talk about that. But before we get to that, Jamal, we're going to watch and listen to a really great interview that you did with Israeli award-winning journalist, Haaretz correspondent, and occupied Palestinian territory, Amira Haas. She's going to talk about the increased settler violence that's been plaguing the West Bank and has been leveled against Palestinians in the West Bank. It's a very, very incredible interview coming from Amira Haas, and we'll watch that before we get to these other stories.
One of my favorite journalists covering basically Palestine, Amira Haas. Let's watch the interview. Last week, another Israeli settler rampage invaded the Palestinian West Bank village of Burqa. Palestinian villagers did their utmost to resist the heavily armed settlers, one of whom killed 19-year-old Palestinian Qusay Jamal Matan. Israeli military was noticeably absent, but when they did arrive, they arrested villager Ammar Asliye, who was wounded by gunfire, as well as three of his children who had rushed to stop the settlers from coming into the village. Settler attacks on Palestinian villages in the occupied territories like this one are ongoing, and Israel military forces offer backup and protection to settlers while apprehending Palestinians when they try to defend themselves against the invaders' aggression. They are implementing Israel's government and military policies. Joining us on Arab Talk this week is journalist Amira Haas in her most recent article in Haaretz, Israel Prevents Palestinians from Defending Themselves as It Empowers the Settlers. Amira Haas explains why it is that for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation in the West Bank, self-defense against Jewish violence is a criminal offense subject to arrest, trial, imprisonment, and heavy fines, or even death. Haas is the Haaretz correspondent for the occupied territories and has been in this position since 1993. She is the author of Drinking the Sea at Gaza, in addition to other books. Welcome back to Arab Talk, Amira.
Thank you.
So let's begin. Explain what happened in last week's Israeli settler invasion of the West Bank village of Burqa, which ended tragically in the murder of 19-year-old Palestinian Qusay.
For this, we should see the whole West Bank as strewn with new outposts, relatively new outposts, illegal and unauthorized settlements. Many of them, in the past 10 or 15 years, started to have sheep or cattle to join a family, one family, and a group of youngsters, either armed or only the grown-ups are armed, but very energetic, with a lot of hormones and zeal, holy zeal even on Saturdays. You know, they shoot even on Saturdays. And these people have realized, so we analyzed, but it was also said openly, that grabbing land only through construction of housing units is not enough. And also agricultural activity doesn't needs a lot of work, and you cannot get hold of a lot of Palestinian land only through agriculture, which was the vogue at the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s. So the new very, very clear, very obvious trend and very learned, studied, planned trend is to plant all kind of outposts, of herding outposts, with one family, some of those groups and some of those bully guards, bullies as guards, and sheep or cattle or cows. And they just spread, you know, around in pasture land, which has served Palestinians for decades, if not more. Even send their cattle to Palestinian and sheep to Palestinian fields and orchards, and threaten Palestinians who try to defend their property and themselves and their cattle and sheep, threaten them, hitting them, beating them, using arms, shooting in the air, and very often also are accompanied by army, or sometimes the army comes later because there is a friction. And the army has the priority is to guard and to guard the life of Israeli Jews, even when they are engaged in criminal activities. So this is the reality. Now, Burqa is surrounded by several such outposts. Three are relatively old, and one goes being dismantled and then built again. And lately, so we heard that the Israeli, even the military authorities, asked to dismantle this outpost, but Smotrich refused. And then there is a fourth one nearby, and relatively new. So from all over, this village of Burqa is encircled by this violent outpost. I heard already a year and a half ago that some people complaining that they cannot reach their land where they started to plant something because of one of the bullies in one of the outposts, which, by the way, is in the same site of an outpost that was removed about 8 years ago or 9 years ago. So it's a new outpost on the old site of an outpost, which, and the lands belong to Burqa. So the injustice here is manifold. From every angle you look at it, there is injustice. Now, I cross often, Burqa is actually a besieged village. Because of the oldest outpost, it is the villagers are not allowed to go straight from their village to Ramallah. They actually had a shorter way from their village to Ramallah, but it was blocked when the settlement of Psagot was built in 1980. So it's layer over layer and layer over layer of this injustice. Now they have been subject to many such much harassment over the past years from those outposts. And the people, it was not only the Asliya family, but the village people decided to, when they knew that the bullies come get closer to the village and the village lands with their sheep, or goats, I don't know, they decided to protect their land. And there was probably exchange of some, they probably threw stones and the Jewish settlers also threw stones, and one of them shot at them and another one shot at with a pistol. So there were two who were armed. I don't think that there were more. Some of them are very young. But the people went to defend. Now, the Asliya family was arrested only 2 days later under pressure from the Israeli right wing and from Ben-Gvir, the minister of police. That's why they were arrested. Happily, they were released. The military judge found no reason to think that they behaved, that they initiated or anything. And I'm sure that it's because very often the military court, or usually the military court, is not standing side with Palestinians. I think that under the pressure of the real indignation and anger among several groups in Israeli society, the judge ordered to release them without bail, without anything. Or I'm not sure about it, sorry. But he ordered to release them. But after 5 days, almost, they were detained.
So my understanding also, because you're talking about the Palestinians who got arrested, also the Jewish settlers were also arrested, Elisha Yered and Yehiel Indor, who are the suspects in the murder of the 19-year-old Kusai. Right. And then they were released to house arrest as their supporters were singing and dancing. Yeah, go ahead.
One is released to house arrest, and one is still in hospital. He was wounded, and he's detained in hospital as a detainee. There are judges. I mean, the first instance of court, they ordered to release them to a house arrest. Then there was an appeal by the police, and then a higher instance judge decided to leave one, this in hospital, under detention. So he is detained, yeah.
Later on today,
his mates, his what we call the Hill Youth, etc., are going to have a demonstration in Jerusalem to call for his release.
So let's step back here and reverse the scenario. If a Palestinian being accused of the murder of a settler, would he be released to house arrest during investigation, assume he or she even survives the arrest?
Of course, they are not accused yet. They are suspect. It's not. There is no accusation yet. They are suspect. And one of them only, I think, is suspect of the murder. Well, it's almost, you know, no need to answer this question, because, of course, the Palestinians would have been found immediately and would be put in jail and see a judge and then put under interrogation without having the right to see a lawyer for quite some time. Then his detention would be prolonged all the time until the end of the procedures, and he'll be. This is obvious. This is so. It has become such commonplace here that there is a totally different practice when you have an Israeli Jewish suspect and a Palestinian. Not to mention that one is the Jewish one is put in trial, is prosecuted by the Israeli civil court system. And the Palestinian is under military law and military court. So this is the main difference. Then there are differences in the Palestinians can be under detention for 4 days before he is brought to a judge to prolong his detention or not, to decide whether to prolong or not, while the Israeli Jew has to, or the Israeli is after 1 day, has to be brought up to a judge. And there are all kinds of such discrepancies that tell what we are. I mean, there is a law for Palestinians and there is a law for Israelis. And if you are a Jewish Israeli, not a Palestinian Israeli, you'll have it easier with the judges. That's for sure.
One of the suspects, Yared, worked as a spokesperson for a lawmaker in the far-right Jewish Power Party, led by Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. And Ben-Gvir described the two murder suspects on Twitter, now it's called X, as heroes.
Yeah, there is. And when you look at what Elisha Yered wrote, I mean, he's been calling openly for killing Palestinians, and he's pushing the Israeli military to launch a massive military operation against the Palestinians. And it's clear that these kind of people push for escalation, an escalation that will enable all sides, I mean, both the military and mainly the groups among the settlers will enable them to expel Palestinians, to banish them outside of the country. This is unfortunately we've seen this vector growing and becoming clearer and clearer over the years. There is a geographical political aim, a goal behind this violence. This violence is not just the act of you know, hooligans who haven't been laid. You know, like it is a very, very strategized violence, very strategized violence. Like the breaking of even the Israeli law, they break the Israeli law, but at the same time they get support and money and assistance and logistic assistance from Israeli official bodies like Israeli municipalities of the settlements, regional councils in the settlements. They get help from institutions that get governmental money as well. So this is not the whims of a small group, a frustrated group, I don't know, for different reasons.
Then the farce, as you call it, of the arrest of Ammar Asleh, who was wounded by gunfire, and his three children as they rushed to stop the invaders from coming into their village. Talk about how the victim becomes the criminal when one is Palestinian.
Again, I think it's even more standing out because if nobody had been murdered, maybe we would have hardly heard about this incident because Qusay was murdered, so there was more attention put to it. But you have different cases. For example, in Masafer Yatta, in south of the West Bank, where both the Israeli authorities forced the people or tried to force the people to leave the area in order to enable the army to exercise the training there, military drills with live fire. These are villages that have been there since the end of the 19th century. And yes, it's small villages, it's cave villages, cave dwellings, but these are people have been living there and exercising their life as herders and connected to Yatta for decades. And now settlers also, now after the Israeli High Court authorized Israel to expel the people and destroy the villages, the army doesn't do it at one time, but slowly, with all kinds of restrictions here and there. But the settlers now come to the picture. Not now, they came before, but now even more, and harass the Palestinians. They go to their, again, in the same methods that I described before, with the herds, with the sheep, with going to the cistern, water cisterns of a certain family, and more or less controlling it so that the family cannot use it. And then when the people want to defend themselves or to demand that the settlers go, they are being arrested. It has happened with at least two families that I met recently in Masafer Yatta. So they are being criminalized immediately because they dare to stand up against against the invaders. This is all over. You have it in the village Karyut, a beautiful village northeast of Ramallah. Already from the beginning of the Second Intifada, the settlers blocked the main road of this village to the main exit of the village. So the people have to make a big round. The settlers have already taken control of, I don't know how much, maybe 40% of their land. The village has five springs. The settlers got control with the same methods of military-supported violence. Got control of over three springs, and now they desire the fourth spring, which is just, you know, maybe 200 meters away from some of the houses of the village. So every Friday they come, and their people go and bath in the spring because it's holy. So the whole police, the whole military is helping them. A huge group of military is helping them. And when people tried to resist, there was a wave of arrests among the villagers for some weeks. And then people have to pay high fines in order to be released on bail. And this really kills the desire to resist, because you see that nobody is standing with you. And you just don't have a way to act against it. And this is happens, you know, like every village, Mrayer, every village has three or four or five outposts around them, has the same story. You have Bedouin communities in the Jordan Valley that in the last year had to leave. Not Jordan Valley and a bit to the west, they had to leave because of all this violence. This is clear but it fits the Israeli policy of emptying Area C now from Palestinians. So it is not a policy it's not a tactics or behavior of settlers that runs against the Israeli official policy. On the contrary, it assists the Israeli policy where they feel maybe a bit, maybe they don't have the enough resources, or they cannot invent enough lies to tell why people should leave their homes.
In your article, you mentioned actually about this policy. You mentioned accepted military policy towards supporting the settlers, various laws that prevent Palestinians from carrying any kind of arms, and of course the complete disregard by Israel for its obligation as an occupier under international law. I want to get into that words, or the words occupied and settler, which are heard so much that I think they don't carry the outrage that they should. Let's be clear that Israel is and continues to flout international law regarding being an occupier. Occupied has a meaning. Can you explain that clearly for some of our listeners?
Yeah, occupation is accepted I'm not good with legal terms, but and the more I live here, the less I understand the legal explanations of things. But from what I've learned from my left-wing friends, who are also lawyers, under international law and under international law, okay, wars are accepted, you know, wars happen. So the laws come to regulate life of civilians after the war or during the military occupation, to regulate the life in this what should be short period, and an exceptional situation. And one of the main obligations is that the army assumes the responsibilities of an elected government in order to safeguard the life and the welfare of the protected population, which is the occupied population. So this is, and in a way, Israel acknowledges that it is a military rule. I mean, it doesn't matter now. We can discuss the terms, but Israel did accept, let's say, until Oslo. But according to international law, Israel is still the occupier. But from day one after the 67 war, Israel violated its obligation because it started to build the settlements. And the settlements, as I write in this article, the settlements are a blatant violation of of international law. Not only because it's written that the army should not, that there should be no transfer of the occupying population to the occupied land, but also it's against the welfare of the people. Every settlement and every settler are making have made and are making now even more Palestinians' life hell.
The Israeli human rights group Yesh Din reported in February that out of more than 1,500 investigations of settler violence against Palestinians, this includes land seizure, trespassing, vandalism, as well as physical attacks on villagers and shepherds and their livestock, only 7% led to indictments. This brings up images of African Americans right here in the United States during Jim Crow. When faced with aggression by a white person, they could either resist and face being lynched or suffer the violence with no recourse. In your opinion, do you think that this is a correct analogy?
Yes, here they are not the Palestinians here are not citizens. In the States, even though they were second or third or seventh grade. Citizens, still they were citizens. So they were groups that were acted to change the situation. The problem here is that we live in this no man's land, where the great majority of Israelis are sure that the Palestinians live in a if not sovereign state, at least in a semi-independent entity. I mean, the with Oslo, what has happened is that more and more people believe that there is a Palestinian entity and has the responsibilities. We don't control the land, but it doesn't matter because they control the people, they govern the people. So there is no occupation. So there is even, I think that in the States, the situation was clear. And I mean, and there were enough people who wanted to bring a change to it, but here the accommodation of so many people who could know it's not true but did not want, and the ability to completely see these people as belonging to a different entity, maybe taints this analogy. So maybe it's not totally accurate.
There is also the impotence of the Palestinian Authority, since we're talking about Oslo, to protect Palestinians. It also has no jurisdiction over any Jewish settler or any Jew for that matter, regardless of the crime perpetrated. As you say, there is no symmetry under occupation. What relevance, if any, does the Palestinian Authority hold for its people?
I'm sure they are not happy about it, but the relevance is that when you are in the cities or in the towns, which are called Area A, I call it, you have a kind of a istiraha, a kind of vacation from the occupation. So you have it in a very narrow area if you don't leave it, then you can go you just listen on the news and you know from the news what's happening, but then you live as if you live normally in this and the PA the PA was established believing that in 5 years it will be a state and there will be a independent state and government. The thing is that the Israelis imposed, the Israelis from day one did not respect very major articles of Oslo. But one has to know, we know that the whole accords were designed in such a way that will be vague enough in favor of the Israelis. But there are certain articles which were not respected. At the same time, they demand the Palestinians to respect one of the articles or the promise to have security coordination. and to abide by this prohibition to defend Palestinians or to act against Israelis if they come and attack Palestinians. It's not written in such clear words, but this is the reality. The reality that even sometimes settlers enter inside El Bire, where I live, or Ramallah, and if they are not escorted by military, the PA, so if they are escorted and if they are not escorted, the PA police is not there to defend the people. Then they come and they can vandalize cars and shops, as they did some at least twice that I know in nearby my place. And there is no police to stop them, because they know if the police stops them, they will be arrested. So the absurd is that the Palestinian police is prohibited from defending its people, and it's actually obliged to act against its people when it comes to Israeli demands, like people involved in armed activities, etc. The Israelis keep pushing them to go and arrest armed people in Nablus or in Jenin or elsewhere to do their job. But they cannot protect their own people. So this is such a contradiction and such an absurdity that I know that most of the people are upset of it and upset by it. And there is no wonder.
Most Americans here in the United States don't hear about settler crimes. The focus in the U.S. media here is about the Israeli protests against the judicial overhaul. From your perspective, do you see these protests raising public consciousness about the military occupation or fueling debate about, now we hear the word apartheid?
It's not only now. Look, sometimes I wake up in the morning and I think that it will make a change, and I go to sleep and I say it won't make any change. So the protest is very impressive, and I think that it can achieve some things if it succeeds. It achieves some things without even meaning to achieve those in terms of Palestinians, especially in Israel. But so far, the government is going on, is continuing with its regime putsch. But we on the Israeli left, we are very disappointed in many ways, because the realization, the protesters, and I'm not talking about the military, but the rank and file protesters, some seem to be more, to understand more the connections, but it's not enough. And because there is such a strong emphasis in this protest, emphasis on the military, so it's a bit, it's one of those absurds that the military are protesting because they're afraid that with a weakened judicial authority, they will not be protected vis-a-vis international criminal court, if they are prosecuted as war criminals.
I mean, I was reading today, this morning, actually, in your publication in Haaretz, that one of the generals describing what was happening in the occupied territories. He invoked Nazi Germany, which is really very strong.
No, but what's important is this is appalled by the assistance that the army gives to the settlers. And to this, I would say, Sahinom. You know, we've been writing...
Late to the party. I just want to explain what Sahinom is.
Yeah. But still, this awakening and the way that people do make the connections between the settlers' component in Israeli society and the overhaul, and connect between between them and the Israeli think tanks that brought, like Kohelet, that are behind the judicial putsch or the judicial overhaul. Look, it's important. I can only hope that it will continue. But we have our, I mean, I call it a feast of contradictions. And I hope that the contradictions will lead the trend to a more positive. But right now, it's not like that.
Final question. Do you think one of main strategies in Netanyahu in pushing through the judicial overhaul is to streamline and speed up the next major ethnic cleansing of Palestinians? And some people are calling it as the second Nakba.
I think that this right-wing extreme component of the government sees it as a possibility. You have Smotrich and Ben-Gvir who openly have spoken about it openly. Necessarily, Netanyahu it was not part of his open discourse that I can tell. But once he gave those transferists such an important position in his government, and once he decided to give Smotrich the responsibility for the settlements and for the land grab in the West Bank, and at the same time to be the Minister of Finance, who can decide how much more money to steal from the Palestinians, and when he makes Ben-Gvir a Minister of Police, then it's clear that he doesn't care if the trend is towards this. What I say is that you have a big segment, a growing segment of Israeli society that maybe 30 years ago, 40 years ago, even Likud would have been, were disgusted by them and didn't want anything to do with them. But right now, it's a very strong component in the Israeli society. Doesn't have to be the majority, but get so much power that they can, with this, as I said, with this planned, strategized provocations, lead to such an escalation that will force the army to go on an overall military campaign, a military operation that will allow either the army or these groups of settlers, armed militias of settlers, to, as once was said, as to continue to complete what was not done in 48. This is the danger, but we are talking in order to prevent it from happening. I keep saying it's not a prophecy, it's a warning, because it shouldn't happen. We are not talking, we are not in a lab, chemists who analyze chemical reactions. I mean, we live this, and we have to prevent this from happening, this scenario. But the danger is there.
Amira Haas, thank you for coming on Arab Talk.
Thank you.
That's the voice in the face of Amir Haas, award-winning Israeli journalist from Haaretz, perhaps one of the most important journalists covering issues in Palestine over the last number of decades. She gives a very compelling picture and analysis of increased settler colonial violence against Palestinians living in the West Bank, and basically how Palestinians are criminalized, Jamal, for just defending themselves.
Blaming the victim. I mean, this is the thing. And they go under the cover of the Israeli army, or the Israeli army looks the other way. They burn fields, they uproot trees, they kill shepherd sheep, and all of this is going on. She described, of course, all settlements are illegal and they are a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. But now what they're having now is what used to be termed as illegal outposts, but this current Israeli government run by the likes of Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and so forth, they just like allow them to set up these outposts. It could be just like a handful of settlers or two settlers. They just go to a field next to a village, take it over, and then chase away Palestinians from their own land. And then when the Palestinians try to defend themselves, they got shot. This is what happened last week to 19-year-old Kusai. And then if they're not shot, they get arrested by the Israeli military for throwing stones, trying to defend themselves, or just confronting the settlers. It's another step, basically, in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and people have to pay attention to what Smotrich has said just a few days ago, and he said that the failure of Ben-Gurion was not to complete the job of basically ethnically cleansing entire Palestine, and he wants to complete that job.
Well, Ben-Gvir wants to do that. Smotrich wants to complete that unfinished business. But it's important to know that the Netanyahu government, which is run by these right-wing fascist extremists, want to do it also. And so they on a daily basis, not only create these facts on the ground of expanding the colonial illegal settlements, but they are working directly in the government against international efforts, against the United States stated policy, working directly against what the international community wants in terms of some kind of justice, for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and beyond. It's never going to happen with this administration, with the Netanyahu administration. But the U.S. government turns a blind eye to Smotrich, to Ben-Gvir, to Netanyahu. And because of that, they are allowed to run wild against Palestinians in the West Bank, Jamal. It's outrageous. And when Palestinians are murdered and they try to defend themselves and they're murdered for that, we don't hear anything from the White House. We don't hear anything from Hakeem Jeffries. We don't hear anything from these guys, Jamal.
What we're going to be talking about, our story, Jess, of course, which you said in the intro, the ex-Israeli general likens military control of the West Bank to Nazi Germany. Now, a warning right here. This does not meet the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, right? Okay. His name, by the way, is Amiram Levin. He accuses the Israeli occupation army, or as they refer to it, the Israel Defense Forces, IDF, of being a partner in war crimes. This is a general accusing the Israeli military of being a partner in war crimes when it stands by as settler extremists. This is what Amir Haas was talking about, attack Palestinians, and then says again, and here I'm paraphrasing, the situation in the West Bank is absolute apartheid. Here is again that word, the A word that they try to defend, those puppets and surrogates in Congress saying, no, Israel is not a racist state, it's not an apartheid state. I want to backtrack a little bit. Before him 2 weeks ago, Jess, approximately, maybe a little bit more, Tamir Pardoe, the former head of Mossad, described Israel as an apartheid state.
The former head of Mossad, yeah.
A year ago, the former attorney general described in an article he had written that Israel is an apartheid state. And of course, let's not mention Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Israel's own human rights organization, B'Tselem, and others. And then you have these clowns. I'm sorry to say that.
No, they're
our own government going on a junket. They're thinking like they're going to the Caribbean or whatever, like a paid, fully paid junket, going there, dragged by a leash, paraded through Palestine, 1948, historic Palestine. And then they're standing in front of cameras. I mean, I just—it's like unbelievable. I mean, like
we talked a little bit.
Democracy. Israel's a democracy.
And here's the thing: you have Hakeem Jeffries kissing the ring, or other parts of Benjamin Netanyahu, all over the place, coming back and being celebrated for the junket, and from both sides of the aisle, Jamal. And then you have the Progressive Democratic Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, the squad, and some of the other individuals who are crucified for saying that Israel is a racist state, not even saying it's an apartheid state, not even saying it's committing war crimes, just saying it's a racist state. And they get crucified, but you have Israeli generals, ex-Mossad, like the CIA heads, you know, attorneys general. You have the top tier of Israeli intellectual and military establishment saying Israel is an apartheid state. And of course, no one's going to criticize them. They can say it, but when other people say it, then the IHRA definition kicks in, right? And everybody gets labeled anti-Semitic. Hakeem Jeffries, it's not even right to call him weak. It's not even correct enough to call him a puppet. He is a supplicant, is the word that I would use. Who is he representing, Jamal? Is he representing the Democrats in the U.S. Congress, or is he representing the interests of another country? That's my question.
Well, I mean, this is the head-turning thing about it. If whether you define Israel as an apartheid state or not, which we have proven a thousand times that it is, he is working against the interests of the party that he represents. That's why, but we're talking about there is a criticism now, there is, for that Democratic congressional delegation that's led by him now is coming under fire for visiting apartheid Israel and going on a trip funded by the lobby group, which really should be registered as a foreign agent, APAC, the Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is working to defeat other members of the Democratic Party in the next year's elections. I mean, imagine you're
Hakeem.
And where does this guy so disconnected or what? I mean, is APAC money so blinding, Jess?
Yes.
That you forsake your own party's interests.
Yes. Yes,
and you know they're working to unseat AOC. They're working to unseat Rashida Tlaib. They're working to unseat Jamal Bowman and others. And then you go hand in hand on this junket, like as if you're, like I said, like going on a vacation. Bury your head in the sand. Not only this, it's enough that you go, like, you know, I have to say, sadly, in the Bay Area here, about a month ago or so, Mayor London Breed
went
there during the peak of the demonstration. Like, even if you're not going there to show solidarity with Palestinians or whatever, you don't go there to show solidarity for the thousands or hundreds of thousands of Israelis who are demonstrating against their own government. London Breed went to Haifa for another junket trip organized by JCRC to say that Haifa is a sister city, but she did not make publicity about it. She went quietly. Exposed that on this show. We talked about this on this show, but she went, slipped in quietly and came back. These guys didn't slip in and go there and come back quietly.
They were proud of it.
They're coming back parading like clowns, recording messages and tweeting and interviews and whatever, saying what they saw there is a democracy and Israel is our strongest ally and there is no racism in the country, and making up stuff like this, like, oh, there are Arabs who are in the Israeli Knesset and you know, they can go to school, whatever. Yeah, sure. You know, there were also during Jim Crow, you know, African Americans, they walk the streets, like they're saying, okay, what are they supposed to do, Palestinians, in the 1948? And the question is, how many of them met with him? Most of them, 99.9%, refused to be in the same room with him alone.
Of course. Well, here's the thing, Jamal. Hakeem Jeffries is an African American man. London Breed is an African American woman. And both of them are these supplicants for the JCRC or for APAC. And the idea, and listen, the other thing about Hakeem Jeffries, which is kind of crazy, and with London Breed, they condemned Ron DeSantis for his statement about slavery being beneficial to African Americans, which is a crazy comment. So on the one hand, they're able to criticize Ron DeSantis for a crazy comment about slavery being beneficial to slaves, which is crazy by itself. But the parallel is there. Saying that Israel is a democracy and celebrating it, Jamal, is like saying slavery was good for the slaves. It's such a crazy denial of reality that Hakeem Jeffries, and look at his name, Hakeem Jeffries is living in a delusional world. And to answer your question directly, yes, he's serving the interests of another country ahead of the interests of his own party and his own country, Jamal, full stop. And guess what? He gets away with it. And he'll continue to get away with it.
No, he's not going to get away with it because I see actually criticism from his own party now, and I'm reading different statements. And this is not concerning just because he went to whitewash Israeli crimes, but people saying this is from the Justice Democrats, which helped fund election campaigns for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, and others, are saying every Democratic member who went on this trip is endorsing APAC's right-wing primary challenges to their colleagues.
Right.
The over 100 Republicans who voted to overturn the election and the Israeli government's brutal apartheid regime. This is a very strong statement. They're making the case about the betrayal that Hakeem Jeffries is leading, and also the endorsement of Israel's apartheid regime. I don't think you would have heard that a year or 2 years ago from the Democrats.
No, but I want that picture of Hakeem Jeffries kissing the ring or the rear of Benjamin Netanyahu, Jamal. That picture needs to be plastered all over Washington Post, New York Times, you know, X, formerly known as Twitter, I mean, Facebook, everywhere. People need to see the reality of Hakeem Jeffries. And what is really disturbing about Hakeem Jeffries, he's hand-selected by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrat leadership to lead the Democratic Party into the next wave of elections. How can they trust somebody like Hakeem Jeffries? How?
Listen, even the Israelis themselves, the leadership of those who have been demonstrating against Netanyahu's judicial reform, they've made a statement. They said, don't come.
Right.
They said, "Why don't come." And they are the leaders of the mass protest movement against the judicial reform. And they
say, don't give Israeli government cover.
And,
exactly.
And said they wanted, even when they came there to even meet with him after
he
didn't listen. And they said the Democratic delegation did not respond to requests for a meeting. They said, at least, okay, now you're here. Let's meet, explain to you why we don't want you to support Netanyahu. And they're quoted in Haaretz, describing Jeffries as making statements about the process that echo the emerging Republican talking points on the matter rather than the growing number of Democrats voicing concern. And then, of course, as we said earlier, AIPAC posted a series of videos on Twitter of members of the delegation pledging their support for Israel. This is one of the guys who represents the Israelis said this was embarrassing. It was as if they were on some junket in Tahiti and ignoring the reality of what was going around them.
Exactly, Jamal. Very strong statement coming from Israelis, condemning Hakeem Jeffries. But as I said, despite that criticism and the criticism from the AOC committee, the problem is that he will skate free. He will not have any consequences. He will not be held accountable. I know this is a strong statement. It borders on treasonous. It's treachery. It's, you know, you have a black man here supporting apartheid. It's kind of mind-boggling. That he could, as I said before, he could criticize Ron DeSantis, yet go to this place where people are being oppressed and occupied, killed, murdered, by the way, with U.S. money and U.S. support and U.S. weapons. So Hakeem, what, I don't even want to say what's going on. We know what's going on. You're serving the interests of another country. And you're not serving the interests of the Democratic Party, let alone your own constituency, let alone the country. which you have sworn to uphold and protect. It's kind of bizarre. I mean, we need to release the name of all the Democrats that went on this junket, Jamal, not just Hakim. Hakim is the leader, but we should release all of these names.
Tone deaf. They're all tone deaf. I guess money is blinding. I also recommend, which we don't have time to talk about it, an article I read by Max Blumenthal.
Oh, yeah.
Addressing Hakim Jeffries, who says he serves his AIPAC masters, and which I didn't know a lot about Hakim Jeffries. I mean, but this one delves into his past and talks about how back in 1992, Hakim Jeffries published an op-ed for his college newspaper denouncing Clarence Thomas and Colin Powell as house Negroes and token blacks, propped up by racist moneyed elements to advance their interests of the white masters and so on. He quoted Augusto Sandino, the Nicaraguan guerrilla leader who resisted the U.S. Marine invasion of his country to paint the U.S. military as the policemen of the Wall Street bankers. And then fast forward 30 years later, Hakim is junketed to Israel as the leader of an AIPAC delegation of Democratic members of Congress, including several black and Latino progressives, great article, because it kind of goes way in depth about the past before and after Hakim, and sadly that's what happens to politicians when they make it to Congress and they start seeing all these interest groups throwing money at them either to defeat them or to elect them, and they sell their principles.
But AIPAC's stated mission is to defeat Democrats. Come on.
He doesn't care.
Yeah, that's my point. Hakim is in a world of his own, and whatever it takes for him to be held accountable, it may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, but eventually it's going to catch up to him, because Hakim Jeffries is on the wrong side of history. Again, Jamal, he may have been on the right side of history in 1992 when he called out Clarence Thomas and Colin Powell. But today, 2023, in August, he's on the wrong side of history. And eventually he will account for that.
You've been listening to Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. Go to our website, arabtalkradio.com, to download the latest shows, and we'll speak to you next week.
See you next week.